Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. There hasn't been another earthquake to match the one in Alaska 60 years ago, but that doesn't mean the Good Friday earthquake of 1964 is far from people's lives. The quake measured 9.2 on the Richter scale, and its magnitude and the consequences for people informs what seismologists all over the world know about earthquakes and how to prepare for them. But at the time, the 1964 earthquake dealt a devastating blow to the people of Southeast Alaska and even thousands of miles away. We'll hear all about it right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Without a direct route, it takes 3 hours for one community on the Navajo Reservation to get medical care and other services in a town that's only 45 miles away. But if a new road was built, it would take about 30 minutes. KUER's Tilda Wilson reports for the Mountain West News Bureau on efforts to find Utah state funding.
The first step for building the connecting road is a $4 million environmental impact study. The Navajo Nation has committed to paying for half of that. Council Speaker Crystalyn Curley says the remaining share was initially included in this year's state budget, but it was pulled at the last minute.
This morning, we were told that we look underneath every cushion, underneath every couch, and we can't find $2 million.
This is the third year in a row that this has happened. State funding early on is critical to obtaining federal money for the $140 million project. Democratic Senator Nate Bluin supports the road.
It's $2 million of a $28 billion budget. It's a fraction of a percent. And to shove it off as a, you know, low budget year, especially when this has been brought forward for a number of years, is, I think, a bit disingenuous.
The Navajo Nation has pushed for the road for the past 15 years. Curley says they'll continue to be persistent until they get the road constructed.
That was Tilda Wilson reporting. The Nebraska Winnebago Tribe's Ho-Chunk Community Development Corporation, or HCCDC, has been awarded $2 million through Mackenzie Scott's Yield Giving Company. Deborah Van Fleet has more.
Some 6,300 nonprofits applied to Yield Giving's open call for grants, and HCCDC was among 279 to receive a top-tier rating. 82 organizations in the next highest tier each received $1 million. HCCDC Executive Director Christine Earth says the tribe has a lot to be proud of, but a lot of work left to do.
We're so excited and we're so thankful for this generous gift for our community. We do have a lot of issues. We have a lot of health disparities, and so a donation like this really is going to make an impact for our entire tribe as a whole.
HCCDC marks its 20th anniversary this year, working to improve economic, educational, and social opportunities for tribal members. Earth says it also has five key initiatives: housing development, commercial development, financial services, quality of life, and food sovereignty. The Winnebago tribe has experienced huge growth in its middle class in the past few decades, but roughly 30% of its members still live in poverty. Earth says through its farmers market, HCCDC is tackling both health disparities and food sovereignty.
Through our farmers market, now we're able to touch on not only agriculture and tribal farming, but also our healthcare system, offering the fresh fruits and vegetables and the Indian corn, things that will restore the health of our people.
Earth says Winnebago is in a food desert, making food security a major focus for the tribe.
It's hard for people to access fresh fruits and vegetables, and we have such a growing community. We are all coming together to grow our own food and to feed ourselves so we can be sustainable in the future.
On the website, Mackenzie Scott calls all the open call grant winners vital agents of change. I'm Deborah Van Fleet.
Traditional games kick off Friday in Juneau, Alaska. Athletes from 29 teams across Alaska, Canada, and the lower 48 are expected to compete. More than 260 middle school, high school, college, and adult athletes from more than 20 communities will take part in 12 events based on hunting and survival skills of Indigenous people. The games are different from other sports, as athletes competing against one another also encourage each other to reach new personal bests. Coaches give helpful tips and guidance to athletes from opposing teams. The event is open to parents and adults, and non-Native athletes are also welcome to compete. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Drummond Woodsum, a full-service law firm whose nationally recognized tribal nations practice provides services to tribal nations and their enterprises and to companies that do business with tribes across the country. More at dwmlaw.com. Does your club, institution, or other group need custom-branded apparel? A wide variety of t-shirts, hoodies, and much more, all custom-printed or embroidered, are available from nativescreenprinting.com, a division of Sky Screen Printing, who support this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. North America's most powerful earthquake struck just south of Anchorage, Alaska on Good Friday, 1964. The quake lasted more than 4.5 minutes, tearing apart the ground and any structures in its path. It also generated a wall of water that largely wiped out the village of Chuniga and caused major damage to places like Kodiak, Seward, Valdez, and Whittier. More than 130 people lost their lives. For those who witnessed it, the enormous scale of the destruction is impossible to forget. If there is a silver lining 60 years later, it's the large body of knowledge scientists and emergency management officials have gained that informs current seismic monitoring and earthquake preparedness. Today, we'll get some personal accounts of the Great Alaska Earthquake. We'll also learn how it changed the way Alaska and the rest of the world view earthquakes. Join our discussion by calling 1-800-996-2848. Do you remember the earthquake on Good Friday, 1964? Tell us your story. That number is also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us now from Valdez, Alaska, is Fred Christofferson. He is a member of the Valdez Native Tribe. Good morning, Fred, and welcome to the show.
Good morning, Sean. Thank you.
Joining us from Kodiak, Alaska, is Gary Watson. He is the board president of Antone Larson, Inc., an Alaska Native corporation, and also a former board member of the Kodiak Area Native Association. He is a member of the Shunack Tribe of Kodiak. Gary, good morning to you as well.
Hey, good morning, and thank you.
And joining us from Fairbanks, Alaska, is Michael West. He is a seismologist for the state of Alaska at the Alaska Earthquake Center in Fairbanks. Good morning, Michael. Good to have you on the show as well.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Fred, I'm going to go ahead and start with you today. It's been 60 years since this earthquake. I think most people living in Alaska today probably weren't even born when it occurred. What do you remember most about that fateful day, March 27th, 1964?
The biggest memory I have was walking off the dock just when it started, and my friend I was with was Danny Feeks. He was originally from California, and he knew what an earthquake was, so he hollered, "Earthquake, run." Well, hell, I'd never heard the term earthquake before, but I'll tell you what, I turned around and stopped and watched, and he's about a half a block ahead of me, turn around, holler and run, don't look. But I had to turn around quite frequently and see what was going on. And the biggest thing I have, the memory is the ship rising up and down up against the dock where all the people were at that were killed. And the rest of it was, you know, just trying to stay on your pegs on that icy road. But yeah, that's my biggest memory is that wall of water.
Fred, you were a young boy at the time, and you had this friend of yours there from California who had lived through some earthquakes himself. Did you have full comprehension of what was going on just in the midst of that?
Not a thing. When it started, there was a big boom. I thought maybe the bomb went off, so I turned around to the left to see, because it was that was the area I was looking at, was down past Newtown, and I guess that sound I heard was a rock slide over in Shoops Bay, which generated the local wave.
And other people, were there other people alongside you and your friend running for shelter or cover or escape?
No, not right off the dock. We were the only two coming off the dock, and once we got off the dock, people were trying to get in cars and go and what have you. I lived just above the dock area. It was tough going, you know. There's the foam poles, tops of foam poles were snapping, live wires in the water, and you know, that kind of stuff. Just trying to stay on your feet and go.
Do you remember about how high the water was at the time?
Well, by the time I got up to the road that went to the dock, it was about mid-knee on me. And like I say, I would turn around and watch it. If I just probably stayed any longer, I'd probably be with the other ones.
Oh, geez. So a tsunami, that's an event that I don't think most people spend a lot of time thinking about. In that moment, you and the other folks, I mean, were they able to grasp just the enormity of the physical threat and the risk that they were experiencing?
No. Most of the people in Valdez, you know, didn't understand what was going on during the time. I guess we all just thought it was kind of the end of the world because, you know, 4.5 minutes is a hell of a long time to keep a 9-2 going. And there's a lot of devastation. You know, generated that landslide, which generated a local wave.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I don't think anybody realized the enormity of anything but the end of the world.
And you and your friend, during this 4.5 minutes, how far did you run and at what point did it finally let up and when did you get reconnected with family and friends and older people who could, you know, take care of you and help you out?
We ran up a couple blocks, and Danny lived over by the museum, so we hung a left off the main street there and went over a block, and his dad was hanging on to the entryway of the house there trying to stay up. And you know, it was still going pretty good by the time we got to his house, and he bailed off there, and I took off. I had a couple more blocks to go and to get to where I lived. And this old towner come by in his panel van and holler, get in. I said, no, I got to go home trying to see my parents and family. He says, don't worry about them. They're okay. Get in. So anyway, I jumped in the back of that panel van, that big door in the back, and rode around with him for several hours. Nightfall was coming. Everybody in the local area went out to Six Mile Hill because they thought another wave was coming. And they went to Six Mile Hill, the maintenance station at Thompson Pass, and all the lodges on the way up to Glen Allen were full of people from Valdez. By the time it quit shaking, we was probably, up by my house, I guess. Mm-hmm. And we headed for 6 Mile. Anyway, old Ed, he kind of liked his hooch, so we didn't stay out there too long and come back into town. Went over to his house, which was down there right around the end of where the wave hit there in Front Street. And you know, in the dark, had a lantern going. And, you know, the aftershocks are, you know, really severe. And we stayed there for a while. We got enough hooch, and then we took off and it went over to the Glacier Bar. And old Bob Brown, you know, he'd look north and see east and west, and he wanted to know what in the hell was going on. And they told him, he said, well, we had an earthquake. He said everything was falling off the shelves, and he says the jukebox was dancing across the floor until it unplugged itself. So anyway, they sat there and drank some more, and I was all needles and pins. I couldn't sit still, so anyway, I was just roaming around in there, and heard a big boom, so I ran out the front door and looked, and the tank farm had burst into fire. So I went back in and told them, we got to go, the town's on fire.
Oh, my gosh.
Come on, what's wrong? Just a tank farm. We're all right. So they went back in there and drank some more, and then he decided he was going to go down and see the club bar, Larry Parker. And I knew what happened down there. Everything was wiped out. So he headed down there, and as soon as that panel van hit the water, I opened up a big door and bailed out and hauled ass down the street. You know, it's pitch black. There aren't any lights. So I run down there to the new post office and hung a left, and that's a long block to go to the hospital. It was about 3 blocks long, I guess, and I ran headed that way because I seen one light on there. They must have had a generator in there. And I was running down that way, and pretty quick I see some people come out of the hospital and getting a pickup. They had a wooden canopy on it. And just as it was pulling away, I jumped in the back. And the truck stopped, and the fellow that owned it, Lynn Robinson, he got out and looked in there, and he says, who is that? I says, Fred Christopherson. He says, what are you doing? I says, well, I'm scared. I need to go somewhere with somebody. And I was by myself, but anyway.
Okay. So, Fred, I'm sorry. When did you finally get reacquainted with your parents, and how long was it?
Well, 3 days before they found out where I was. Everywhere they went, everybody told them that the last place I was seen was on the dock, and everybody died.
So for 3 days, your parents thought you were gone, probably.
Yeah, they thought I was on the dock.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Fred, I have this vision of you as this young boy with your friend just running, just trying to beat the water. I mean, it sounds like a scene from one of these movies we see on television now about natural disasters. Just unreal to hear your story today. We're going to take a break here. We come back, we're going to talk more with Fred and our other guests. And anybody up in Alaska listening right now, if you were there, if you experienced this powerful, powerful earthquake that struck on Good Friday, 1964, give us a call. We'd love to hear your story. 1-800-99-NATIVE. It took decades to develop the new comprehensive dictionary for the Taíno language. Its organizers referenced numerous sources for word origins and spellings for the indigenous Puerto Rican language. We'll hear about that and some other dedicated language revitalization projects on the next Native America Calling.
I'm Michael, and I used to smoke. I never used to think about breathing. Then my left lung collapsed, and I was diagnosed with COPD. Now I think about breathing all the time. I'm on an oxygen machine so I can breathe. I take medicine so I can breathe. My tip is, enjoy the breaths you don't have to think about. You don't know how long you'll have them.
Smoking can cause COPD. You can quit. For free help, visit cdc.gov/quitnow. A message from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Thanks for listening to Native America Calling. Today, we are hearing about the Great Alaska Earthquake of 1964. It's been 60 years since the 9.2 trembler struck southeast of Anchorage. It's an unforgettable catastrophe for those who lived through it, and an event that still informs what the world knows about major earthquakes. Join our conversation today by calling 1-800-996-2848. Let's take a caller now, Melina, who is listening online in Eugene, Oregon. Good morning, Melina, and thank you for calling in.
Good morning, Sean, and good morning to everybody out there in Indian Country. Thank you for taking the call. I wanted to just take a minute here to breathe a little life into one of my mom's favorite story. We lost her just about a year ago, but the story she told about the 1964 earthquake in Anchorage was being downtown on Fifth Avenue. And she'd just gotten her eyes examined, and they were dilated. So she walked out onto the street onto Fifth Avenue, and things were shaking, and she thought it was her eye exam that caused it. And then all of a sudden, the street split apart in front of her. And then I also wanted to just touch on the fact that my parents had just built a house out on West 73rd in a big, huge hearth. So theirs was one of the only houses in that neighborhood that year that had a hearth where people could come and sit around. So the entire neighborhood came and cooked food and built a big fire in the hearth. And so I really wanted to focus on the importance of social networks in emergency preparedness and management. It was the neighbors and the friends and the community that actually saved each other. And so I now work in tribal emergency management, and I just want to encourage everybody to know your neighbors, work with your neighbors, and that's a huge part of preparing for any kind of disaster. So thank you for letting me share that story. Hello to all our dear friends in the north there. I'm from the Flathead Nation where my mom was a tribal member. So yeah, thanks a lot. It was a good memory to think about the earthquake and my mom sharing that story.
All right, Melina, really appreciate you calling in, and condolences to your family on the loss of your mother. Appreciate, though, you sharing that story with our listeners. Let's now hear an account from Kodiak, the main city on the island of Kodiak in the Gulf of Alaska. Tina Hohen lives in Kodiak and is a member of the Lesnoy Native Village. She remembers getting ready for an Easter gathering with family, and then everything changed.
My oldest daughter was one day short of 4 months old, and I was sitting on the bed in the bedroom. We lived in a trailer, and I was folding diapers. I was watching Sherry Lewis, which is an old television show, and the house started to shake, which wasn't a big deal because we had earthquakes while I was growing up, but this one didn't stop. It got more intense, and there's no way you can describe that, the earth grinding noise that comes with this. Trailers are not as firm as houses, so the walls were kind of giving in 5 or 6 inches, and they would pop back out. And I stood up and I looked out the window, and the trees were whipping back and forth, and cars were jumping around in the parking area, and little boys were out there, and they were being toppled over because the ground was moving, and they were sort of laughing. They thought it was funny. But it was just scary, and you wondered if it was ever going to stop. First thing I thought about was my grandmother, who lived down in the downtown area, and I was wondering if she was all right. So we went downtown, and she was had made Easter bread, Russian Easter bread, and it was cooling on the table, and we were sort of laughing about the house shaking quite a bit, and we were listening to the radio to find out if what was happening. And our radio station was Armed Forces Network. That was the only radio that we had. And the announcer started, he said, everybody get to high ground. The water's rising. The water's rising. And he was running out of the room, fading out of the sound was fading out of the radio. And I got up from the table at my grandmother's house and ran out of the door and out to the road. It was about 50 feet from the road by her house, and I could see down to the boat harbor, which was about 300 feet away, and the water had already risen up over the edge of the harbor and was coming across the road by the edge of the harbor, and it was just kind of slowly bubbling over the road and coming up, and people were standing there and backing up and looking at it and backing up, And the sirens started going off. We started carrying photo albums and the caliche, naturally, and her and some clothes out and her dog, and got in the truck and took her up to my trailer. And then everything hit the fan because the first wave took out the electrical plant. You get tremors every few minutes, and it was just really a strange, scary night. My uncle got his family onto the skipper on a power scow, a barge, and he got his family onto the boat, and they rowed over the water break and rowed the tidal wave out and back and out and back 2 or 3 times. They were very lucky. They made it through. But the next day was just, it was devastating. It was boats floating around in the channel, and the docks were gone, and the harbor was a mess, and the downtown area was flooded with water. My grandmother's house was gone. The house that I grew up in was tilted on its foundations. The commercial area of Kodiak was all downtown, next to the waterfront where the docks were, and the docks, you know, the ships would come in and unload. So all the stores are down there. So there were National Guard were down recovering what they could of canned goods, and martial law was in effect. We had like 7 or 8 bars and liquor stores downtown, and they all got flooded. The docks were a mess. I think the way people came together and helped each other was pretty fabulous, because everybody helped everybody else. It was it brought the whole state kind of hung together, and people were helping other people, and that was pretty tremendous. But Alaska is a place where life is kind of raw anyway, and it still is in ways. So you never know what you're going to get up here, weather-wise or earthquake-wise or what have you. It's just a neat place to live. Even with earthquakes, I'm staying here.
That is Tina Hohen, a lifelong resident of Kodiak, Alaska, recalling the day the earthquake and tsunami struck and the aftermath. Let's hear from our next guest now, Gary Watson. He's in Kodiak, Alaska. And Gary, what do you remember about the actual earthquake itself? We're hearing stories about ground shaking, loud booms. Do you have images from that quake that will just never go away? They're burned in your memory?
Oh, yes, just like yesterday. But I was just a young one. I was 9 years old. I was a street boy for selling newspapers. I remember being really nice outside and everything else. And as what Tina explained, is Kodiak centered right by the water, the downtown area. And I was walking down to DNA Dock, which is one of our canneries, and it had a store and everything else. As I was walking down there, the mug-up room, which were the canneries, people would go and take the break. They had some donuts. I remember walking down the hill, you know, down to the dock area to see if there was any boats, you know, to pawn off my newspapers. And that door was open at the mug-up room. And, of course, I seen some donuts, you know, and I helped myself to a couple. And I was walking further off down the dock. And no sooner I got done with my donut, you know, holy smokers, you know, it started shaking. And, of course, I just stood there wondering what the heck, and it progressed worse. And I don't know if it knocked me down or I just squatted or whatever. I started seeing people running out the cannery and the DNA and everything else. And luckily, the bookkeeper of the cannery, he must have seen me, you know, and he picked me up and he told me, he says, hey, we got to get out of here. And we got right, you know, little past the Kodiak Hotel, heading up towards the hill. And I don't know what he seen, or if it was just the ground was still shaking or whatever have you. But he said, oh, I can't say that word, but he said, oh, geez. You know, and then all of a sudden he just quit and gave me a ride up to the hill. And lucky our house was in the Lucien Homes. I continue on and ran over there. Then my mom with her 5 kids and other kids in the neighborhood, you know, all piled into the car. We ran up Pillar Mountain remember going up towards the hill, and like Fred was saying, the aftershock and everything else, you know, it was a scary ride up. You know, seeing when we got up on top, you know, people started running towards the end of the overlook Kodiak. And that's when, you know, that one of the tidal waves, I believe we had three or so, you know, started happening.
And Gary, I'm sorry, Gary, it's the tidal waves, the tsunami, that's what really caused most of the damage there in Kodiak. Is that right?
Yes. As I was laying there, I don't know if it was the shaking, you know, when the planks started rippling, you know, because I was still laying on the deck in the channel. Yeah. The earthquake itself, I don't know if it caused that much destruction or not. It was a tidal wave that I believe, you know, mucked out Kodiak.
Mm-hmm. Now, we heard from Tina as well as our caller that, you know, people really came together. They were supporting each other. But I'm also interested to know about the official emergency response. Was there a quick action there by emergency services to provide support?
As I recall it, just like Tina explained, I remember the sirens going off big time. You know, that was, you know, all the volunteers. We didn't have a fire department. I mean, we had a fire department, but it was all volunteers. And, you know, people started running down and making sure that everyone was out of the downtown district and heading up towards the mountains.
And the adults who were in your life at the time, what did they tell you during this whole aftermath?
Holy smokers, yeah. That was talked about for quite a while because it mucked out the whole Kodiak downtown area. And the aftermath was, you know, how they were going to restore it and where everyone was going to stay. We didn't have a communication. We had communications, but you know, a lot of people thought that Kodiak was totally wiped off, you know, the earth there, you know. And the old folks knew what to do, you know. They, you know, like Tina said, you know, Kodiak came together and they opened. We had the main school, you know, and the gym area and everything else. And they housed all the people that were their houses that got wiped out.
Jeez. Gary, 9 years old, selling newspapers, and then just in the blink of an eye, your entire world just changed. Just a fascinating account from Gary Watson up in Kodiak, Alaska. Let's take another caller now. Gail, listening in Anchorage on KNBA. Good morning, Gail, and thank you for calling in.
Good morning. I don't have firsthand experience except that I was born a year after the earthquake in Seward. So I've grown up with the stories and the PTSD stories from many family members and acquaintances. First of all, in Kodiak, a friend from Kodiak said one of his greatest funds was going down and play that you'd pick up the cans of food that would wash up on the beach after the earthquake and you would get a surprise dinner.
Okay, so people were able to just get food like that, scavenge, and wow.
And it wasn't just that they necessarily had to at that point, but it was mystery food, you know? A tin of food is washed up on the beach.
Yeah.
And then in Seward, I just remember all the time saying, you know, why is there a railroad car clear over here on the other side of town from the railroad tracks? And the standard answer was the earthquake. The water moved it. And for a child to try and picture that, it's still, you don't get it. The stories of the whole dock falling off and like the whole end of town just disappearing, in Seward. And then I finally got up the courage to ask an older person what my grandma, what she remembers. And you could see the PTSD kind of click into her eyes. And she said, we were cooking spaghetti. And the sauce was on the ceiling and everywhere. So this boiling sauce just went everywhere. Her bookcases fell over. Her sister stopped talking for a week. And the town pulled together and they went and kind of lived in a, I don't know whether it was the old Jesse Lee home or another building, but everybody congregated in that area to sleep and eat and get the fresh water supplies.
Geez, Gail, this is just another really, really, wow, just overwhelming account. And to hear you describe it and to describe the symptoms of PTSD and 60 years ago, I imagine, you know, nobody was even really thinking about just the mental health implications of what people there were experiencing and what they went through. So really appreciate you calling in today, Gail. We're going to take another break here, and we're going to keep these phone lines open, and let's get some more calls going. Let's hear some more personal accounts as well as sharing stories from grandparents and parents who may have lived through the great earthquake. We're going to keep these phone lines going. So give us a call, 1-800-99-NATIVE, and we'll be right back, and we're going to talk more with Gary Watson.
Pursuing a degree in higher education is attainable, and with a scholarship from Native Forward Scholars Fund, it is more affordable. From aerospace to veterinary medicine, as the largest direct scholarship provider to Native students in the U.S., Native Forward has empowered over 22,000 students from over 500 tribes in all 50 states in pursuit of their undergraduate, graduate, and professional degrees. Info and applications at nativeforward.org. Who support this show.
We're glad you're along with us today on Native America Calling. I'm your host, Sean Spruce. Do you have a memory of the Great Alaska Earthquake of 1964? Let us know. Share your story by calling 1-800-996-2848. Let's go back now to Gary Watson in Kodiak, Alaska. And Gary, these stories, both from you and from Fred and our callers, just so, so fascinating to hear. Let's talk a little bit about the aftermath, the long-term impacts. Here it's been 60 years. What is the long-term impact there on Kodiak? How has it been changed? What's different about the community since this huge earthquake 60 years ago?
In my view, you know, as a kid, you always have fond memories, you know, but as what I seen it today, you know, like, holy smokers, you know, what devastation and where Kodiak came together and formed what Kodiak is. But we were faced with a lot of obstacles aftermath, too. And like I was saying, lucky the Red Cross and Urban Renewal and Oregon Mills and that came together and they start restoring Kodiak. You know, the Kodiak sunk what I believe, you know, 4 foot or 6 foot, something like that, I heard, you know, and, you know, they had to clear out quite a bit of an area and rebuild. You know, I heard there was what was overlay of 6 foot of gravel and everything else because we sunk. And as what we see today, you know, it's still in a, I believe it's still in a disaster area downtown. And the impacts of it, you know, Kodiak's known for its major disasters. Mm-hmm. I mean, well known. And it's devastating, you know, it really is. But the 64 really did change Kodiak.
And Gary, when that earthquake hit, that aftermath, the shock waves, the tsunami, oh, geez, about how long did it take for life to get back to some level of normalcy? Was it days, weeks, months?
Well, it went in series, I believe. Of course, I was young, you know, and it was more or less getting community power, you know, because like Tina was saying, the first way that it where our electric company was right downtown, and you know, mucked out all of the power and everything else. And once they got that restored and the communications, you know, with the telephone line, because we have the White Alice radar site, they had a office up on the hill, which, you know, they started communicating. And that's, you know, but the answer to your question, to me, you know, after they formed everything as what they're doing and how they're prioritizing, it took a long time, don't get me wrong, uh-huh. You know, but it didn't take that long, because it was our main store, Crafts, was wiped out, you know, so that was a priority. And what did the base and the Navy personnel, you know, were bringing in supplies and that right afterwards. But it within a year or so, I believe we're pretty much sustainable.
About a year.
Yeah, that's how I recall it. It could
sure.
be longer.
Okay. Gary, really appreciate you coming on the show today and sharing your stories and your memories. Let's talk now to Michael West. He's our next guest, and he is a seismologist with the state of Alaska. Michael, thank you again for joining our show. And let's take a different angle here and talk a little bit about what the impact has been on science and engineering, and specifically the influence of this earthquake on how buildings are constructed in earthquake zones and towns are designed. What can you tell our listeners?
Thanks. You know, it's really humbling to hear the stories of folks from that day and from that whole time period. And it really does drive home how, yes, there was a catastrophic several minutes, but it set the stage for so many things across the state in the, you know, the next few decades to come. This was a boom time in Alaska. We hadn't been a state for all that long. The Trans-Alaska Pipeline wasn't but a decade or so later, and the boom that came with that. But all of that was done with the stories of Fred and Gary and Tina, but you know, thousands of people with stories like that, and it influenced how we did things. For a few decades, Anchorage had some of the most advanced building codes in the nation. Eventually, the rest of the country caught up, but it's not all the time that Alaska gets to claim to be the leader in something like that. But that was 100% due to the earthquake. All the things that we built, the marine terminal in Valdez and all the ports that were rebuilt, the Port of Anchorage, these things were all done with 1964, passion or desire to make sure that we were building strong, but also with all the science that came out of that earthquake.
This is fascinating. Michael, is there any way to describe just how much power is generated by a 9.2 earthquake?
Your guess do a great job of this, because we've got Valdez represented. We've got Kodiak represented. Kodiak and Valdez are really far apart, like probably 300, 350 miles as the crow flies. That's a huge distance. This earthquake actually began very close to Valdez, Prince William Sound. And you were talking earlier about that 4.5 minutes. what was happening during those 4.5 minutes is that earthquake was propagating or unzipping, if you will, from Valdez to Kodiak. Imagine anything going from Valdez to Kodiak in 4.5 minutes. You know, and that a huge rupture within the earth was taking place, and it took time. It was such a big earthquake that it took 4.5 minutes just for that break to happen.
Michael, what about the geography? I understand it's changed in a lot of places because of the earthquake. What are some permanent changes there in the geography since this earthquake in 1964?
Well, I think it was Gary mentioning, forgive me if I'm wrong, but Gary was mentioning that the harbor area in Kodiak was lower, permanently lower than it was prior to the earthquake. So we think a lot about the shaking that happened during that earthquake and the tsunami for obvious reasons. But what those were doing is what all earthquakes do is they allow the earth to take on a new shape, if you will, right? There was a whole bunch of pent up strain, and when that released, the earth was in a different position. So all around, whether you're if you're in the Anchorage area and you see the salt flats, the so-called ghost forests, these were areas that were lowered during the earthquake, and the other places were uplifted by 5, 10, 15 feet from where they had been. So those are permanent changes to Alaska's coastline.
And Michael, as a seismologist, I mean, you're constantly monitoring the earth for changes, for shifts. Any possibility, any risk that a similar earthquake of a similar magnitude could again strike there in Alaska?
This is something that the research community has spent 60 years on. It's always a little tricky, but I would say it this way, that precise earthquake, the exact sort of rupture and where this earthquake took place, we don't expect that same earthquake to happen again for some hundreds of years, probably. Emphasis on probably. However, the impacts, the kinds of things that were generated, that is, the violent shaking that could last minutes, devastating tsunami, uplift, that can happen from earthquakes that maybe look different than 1964. So all of those impacts are just a fact of baked into where we live.
Now, the technology that you have at your disposal to measure seismic shifts and perhaps an oncoming earthquake, how does that compare to what they had in 1964? I mean, did they have the technology to really be proactive when that earthquake hit?
In a word, no. Most all of the seismic analysis, the monitoring, the trying to inform building codes that consume a lot of our attention here at the Alaska Earthquake Center now, really most of that started in the days following the 1964 earthquake. I mean, it's that simple. That is our origin story.
Mm-hmm. So at that time, there would have been no heads up probably, just it hit and everybody was caught blindsided.
It's fascinating to read the literature from that time because we didn't really understand. A lot of your listeners have probably been exposed to the basic ideas of plate tectonics, right? That they're big pieces of earth that move around and slowly jostle for position on the globe. That was all kind of a concept, it kind of floating out there, but wasn't really understood yet in 1964. So when that earthquake happened, there were vigorous debates about where did this even come from? We didn't have a framework for explaining, that's why that earthquake occurred.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember earth science in eighth grade, Michael, but you're giving me a refresher in that. Let's take another caller now, Vicky in Anchorage, Alaska. Good morning, Vicky. We've got time for you to talk.
Good morning, Sean. Thanks for taking my call. I wasn't a part of the 64 earthquake, but I was part of the one we had in Anchorage in 2018. And I think that anyone who had to deal with the aftershocks of all that whole 64 quake is awful, because my PTSD has been going off all through your show, and I've enjoyed hearing everybody talk about it.
All right. Thank you, Vicky, for that call, mentioning the 2018 earthquake, which still measured 7.1 on the Richter scale. So that was really, really impactful as well. Let's go back now to Fred Christofferson. And Fred, talk a little bit about, you know, this legacy now, 60 years later, and what has it really done in terms of your life and your family and your community? How has it impacted you folks? And what do you want our listeners to really understand here on this anniversary almost of the 64 earthquake?
Well, I guess the biggest impact is the way I led my life. You know, back in 64, nobody knew what PTSD or survivor's remorse is. I've lived both of those all these years, but it's just changed the way I work around the water. It took years before I even went down to the old town where the quake happened, because Valdez was relocated over what they call New Valdez now in 1968. So they moved the town all the way over onto some bedrock, because the old town was just on alluvial rain from, you know, the glacier. And, but yeah, it's made a big change in the way I do things. It took me years, like I say, to go on the water. And even though my dad was born and raised in Kodiak, we had a boat in Old Valdez. He just come back up from getting the papers off the boat, and what made him go do that is beyond me. And you know, if he'd hung around down there another half hour or so, he'd have been gone too.
Did you lose a lot of relatives, Fred, during that earthquake?
We didn't lose any, which was a surprise, you know, because Danny and I were walking off the dock, our little schoolmate, Larry, and his family drove down onto the dock and pulled over to the right side behind the warehouse on the right. And they were killed, the whole family. And then I met the coach and his two little boys. He had one on his shoulder and holding the hand of the other one with his left. And they were all killed. But no, we didn't lose any family. You know, I'm the eldest of 10, and we're all still kicking. You know, but we all probably went through that PTSD and didn't even know it.
Right, right. Yeah, that's what's so disturbing as well, is that whole issue of the mental health and the impact there. Just, I mean, Fred, this is just a miracle, really, to hear you describe it, that you and your whole family survived, as well as our other guests who've joined us today to share their stories. Just, again, just a transfixing show with some of these personal accounts, as well as the scientific and the engineering perspective that we were also able to provide. So big thanks to all of our guests today, Gary Watson, Fred Christofferson, Michael West, and Tina Hohen, as we remember the 1964 earthquake in Alaska. We'll be back again tomorrow. This time, we're looking into some especially dedicated language revitalization efforts. Hope you'll join us. I'm Sean Spruce.
Support from Dartmouth College, hosting its first Tribal Leadership Academy August 4th to the 10th in New Hampshire. Up to 25 new or appointed tribal government leaders and a group of experienced presenters will consider intergovernmental relations, economic development, healthcare, natural resources, and tribal law and order. Dartmouth College will cover the travel and attendance costs. Application available at dartmouthtriballeadershipacademy.com. Application deadline is May 1st, 2024.
Celebrate National Nutrition Month
Choose healthier food options for you and your loved ones. Sometimes it can be difficult to make good food choices, but there are many resources that can help. For more information, visit ihs.gov/diabetes or call 1-800-318-2596. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.